Hi, I'm Maureen Gibbons. This is number 0140, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0140. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, we'll talk to Dennis Hoff, the owner of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Nevada, who has a thought or two on the Secret Service men who got themselves in a little trouble in Colombia.
I am really disturbed about this. You know, you're threatening our national security by doing this. And the bigger issue is in this terrible economy, I want Americans to buy American. And these Secret Service guys should have stopped by the Bunny Ranch on the way to Colombia and took care of their business, and then we wouldn't have all this big scandal right now.
Michael Boccia is the author of On the Count, Madness, Humor, and Mental Health Care in a Maximum Security Prison.
One of the things that the book talks about that you don't hear too much about are some of the positive aspects of the potential for rehabilitation and the programs and dedicated corrections personnel who work in those programs. And of course, success in those programs, and for the inmates to effectively change their lives and lifestyles requires their earnest motivation to do so.
There's a retro interview with the late Academy Award winning actor Carl Malden. Starring in TV's The Streets of San Francisco gave his career a real boost.
It's one of the best things I ever did because I made a lot of money off of that show. It ran 5 years. And I followed that with a thing that ran 21 years. That's American Express Traveler's Checks. And I tell people even today, don't leave home without.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0140, is Maureen Gibbons, a great friend of mine from back in the day. And if I have to admit it, she was also the subject of an early teenage crush of mine. Ooh. Thank you very much, Maureen, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, don't think about telling 19-year-old Matt Wilkes that old adage that lightning never strikes twice in the same place. Wilkes, who stands at 6'4", was in fact struck by lightning twice in one afternoon after he went out with an umbrella hat that he bought at a bar crawl. Matt said he had gone into his back garden to show his mom when two separate bolts zapped him. But it may have been that goofy hat that actually saved his life. He says, "It felt weird, like being hit on the head really hard." Matt, from Ryde on the Isle of Wight, went to the hospital where medics confirmed that he had been hit by lightning but was otherwise unhurt. One of the doctors suggested he buy a lottery ticket. Okay. At one time or another, everybody is a fashion critic, so I'm just assuming that God said, "Wait a minute, an umbrella hat? Oh, hell no." That's all I'm saying. Well, this is the second week in a row now that we've had a story about someone stripping naked at an airport. Last week it was Denver, this week it's in Oregon. In Portland, 49-year-old John E. Brennan insists he was nude but not lewd at Portland International Airport. While going through airport security, Brennan stripped down to his birthday suit in what he called a protest against airport security screeners. He insists his act of defiance is protected political speech, but airport security didn't see it that way and charged him with disorderly conduct and indecent exposure. Reaction from other passengers was mixed. Some covered their eyes and the eyes of their children, while others laughed and took photos. The disorderly conduct charge was dropped at Brennan's arraignment. Brennan said in an interview that he did not arrive at the airport with the intention of getting naked, but made the impromptu decision after he was pulled aside after going through the metal detector and a pat-down. Police officers arrested Brennan after he ignored requests to get dressed, kind of ironic given that Portland hosts the World Naked Bike Ride, which attracts thousands of nude bikers each year to protest oil dependence. I say they should have just kept him that way, you know, nude, overnight, in a cell, on a metal bench with the air conditioning turned on. He might just rethink his stance after that. Well, it looks like we found the world's worst driver ever, and police in New Mexico are truly baffled. Despite being surrounded by miles and miles of empty desert in Rio Rancho Sandoval, New Mexico, a woman managed to plow her vehicle into the sole telegraph pole standing in the middle of a wide-open desert. And she really hit it, causing the pole to snap and pretty much total the car. Amazingly, the driver of the vehicle had no life-threatening injuries and was taken to hospital as a precaution. Now, if she managed to hit the only thing for miles and miles and miles around, how does she do in traffic? Yeah. Meanwhile, in Munich, Germany, a man called police for help, claiming he was being held prisoner by a woman who kept demanding sex. After several amicable agreed-upon rolls in the hay, the man reportedly tried to leave the woman's apartment, but she wouldn't let him exit and instead allegedly insisted on more sex. That's when the man called the cops for help. Perhaps the woman in question was unaware of a study reported by Forbes that found that while women can, for the most part, never have too much sex, men can. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in Egypt, a man who decided to watch a porn film for the very first time in his life got way more than he expected when he discovered the star of the film was, wait for it, his own wife. The man from Dakhalia only gave the last name of Ramadan and reportedly collapsed in disbelief on the floor of an internet shop. When he recovered his composure, he rushed home to confront his wife, who initially denied his accusations. She finally confessed and told Ramadan that she had never loved him, even though they had been married for 16 years and had 4 children together. Ramadan told Egyptian newspapers, "I found 11 films showing my wife in indecent scenes with her lover. It was the first time I ever watched a porno film, and I did it just out of curiosity." Well, you know what they say, don't they? Curiosity killed the cat. And in this case, it broke up a marriage, too. Happy? Yeah. Anyway, while we're on the topic of sex, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program this week, shall we? You no doubt have been following some of the scandal that has affected the U.S. Secret Service. Some of the agents have basically been caught with their pants down after it was revealed that they had visited a brothel while on a trip to Colombia in advance of President Obama's arrival. Well, Dennis Hoff, the man who owns the Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Carson City, Nevada, has a thought or two about this issue, and he joins us right now on the line from Nevada. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, Peter. Good to hear your voice. I am really disturbed about this. You know, you're threatening our national security by doing this. And the bigger issue is in this terrible economy, I want Americans to buy American. And these Secret Service guys should have stopped by the Bunny Ranch on the way to Colombia and taken care of their business, and then we wouldn't have all this big scandal right now.
Now, the other side of that coin, too, is because, of course, in Colombia, like in Carson City, Nevada, prostitution is legal. But there's also the other question of just because it's legal, there are some things that people shouldn't be doing. And some people say the Secret Service, in this case, it's one of them.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And trying to be a good American, what I've decided to do is to send out a crack blonde forward team to any country our president goes and have those girls at our people's disposal in case they need them.
Wow, I'm just trying to figure out how they get the visas to enter some of those countries.
Well, we'll get it done, and I'll send the blondourage, you know, 6 killer blondes that I love, that I know like to have a good time, and if the Secret Service guys needs help, then we'll help them as to be good Americans.
Now, the club that they were accused of going to, I believe it's called the Play Club in Colombia. I'm assuming, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, that is someone like yourself who is a brothel owner, a legal brothel owner in the United States, you might want to be aware of what the competition might be doing. Are you aware of what other brothels do and how they are ranked? Do you know anything about this particular place in Colombia that the Secret Service might
do? I don't. Not this place specifically, but it, like Canada, I think that the prostitution is legal, but to have a place of prostitution is not legal. That's the Canadian way. In other words, you can have a body rub place, and of course it's a front for sex, and they kind of look the other way, and you can have girls on the street. So that's the way I assume it is. But my problem is this. If you're that bright, and all these guys are typically educated and great guys, if you're that bright and you're going to argue with a girl for $47, something's wrong with you. You need to rethink. The first thing I'd say is, you know what? Okay, I don't feel like the $47 is right. I'm in a foreign country, and I have a very prestigious job looking after the most powerful man in the free world. And I need to pay the $47 and call this a day.
Good point. Good point indeed. Now, I didn't mention in the introduction, but I should have, that there's also an HBO show on called Cat House, which is based on your establishment. That's still going strong?
Absolutely. 10 full years of broadcasting programming in 27 languages in 49 countries around the world. I'm actually going to London mid-May to speak at Oxford University about prostitution.
Oh, you said you're going to London. I thought maybe you're going as part of an advanced team for the Olympics.
I'm going to send my girls for that. That's their job. So I'll be speaking where six U.S. presidents, including Ronald Reagan, and Albert Einstein, Mother Teresa, and the Dalai Lama spoke. So I'm going to be in a very prestigious place teaching them how to sell sex.
Now, I know one of the things that makes you successful is you're not exactly one to kiss and tell, but I will ask this question in a general kind of view, and that is, have you ever known of Secret Service to frequent at any time in the past your establishment?
Yes. Yes. Everybody comes here, all walks of life, and the reason they come there is because it's legal and it's safe. You're not going to get a disease. Nobody's calling the police on you, and nobody's calling your wife. And if these Secret Service guys would have just been smart and bought American, we wouldn't be talking about this.
So not only do you think it's a dumb thing that they did, it's almost as if you were saying it's somewhat unpatriotic and bad for the American economy.
Absolutely. Why outsource jobs that that healthy American girls can do, and better probably?
There's a bumper sticker that I never thought I'd see, but there you go. Dennis?
No, it's true. It's absolutely true. And, you know, I'm coming to Canada now, so I'm working on opening up in Toronto, so we're going to see what happens there.
Oh, I don't know if Toronto's ready for you. There might be some cities out west, or maybe here in Quebec, that might be a little bit more accommodating, let's say.
Well, maybe I better come and visit. But you know, with the laws being changed like they are, they're finally going to wake up and do this right. Right now, I figure in Toronto, Greater Toronto area, there's $250 million that's going into the underground society that should be going into the tax base.
Interesting point. Dennis, it's always a pleasure to talk with you and have you on the program. I thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. I know you're a very busy guy, and you're actually talking to us from your car right now, so thanks for being on the program.
Thank you. I'm glad we got a good, clean line. And maybe when I come to Toronto mid-June, I'll come see you.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Dennis Hoff, the owner of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Nevada. You can see his HBO show, Cat House. Just check your local listings. And you can also visit my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0140, and you'll find links to Dennis's website.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for now and forever, unless the Mayans were right.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to Michael Boccia, who is a former prison psychologist. He's the author of the book On the Count, and he talks about life inside a maximum security facility as a psychologist. And we'll also have a retro interview. We'll go back in time to an interview I was lucky enough to do several years ago with Carl Malden, the Academy Award winning actor. And you'll hear that interview, or at least part of it. Plus, of course, there is an idiot of the day. And that all comes up after more Stuff File news right here, right now. It seems that all sects of society have those known as the dumb ones of the group. Apparently, even terrorists have them. And if there is such a thing as an award for dumbest terrorist ever, that would go to Mohammed Ashen, a mid-level Taliban commander in East Afghanistan. It seems Ashen walked up to a police checkpoint last week, pointed to a wanted poster featuring his face, and asked for the $100 finder's fee noted on the poster. When a shock security commander asked, "Is that you?" Ashen replied, "Yes. Yes, that's me. Can I get my award now?" Instead, soldiers arrested him on the spot and took him straight to jail. Ashen is suspected of plotting attacks on Afghan security forces and is quickly becoming the butt of many jokes, such as the American official who called Ashen the Taliban equivalent of the Home Alone burglars, while another simply told the Washington Post, "Clearly, this man is an imbecile." Now, I could have easily made him the idiot of the day, but frankly, I don't think I'd ever bestow that moniker on a terrorist. Otherwise, I would have given it to either the underwear bomber or the guy who tried to blow up his own shoes on a flight. No, let's just leave it at imbecile. But there is an idiot of the day. That's coming up a little later. Wait for it. In Vero Beach, Florida, 36-year-old Michael Lynn Ogborn clearly has some anger management issues. Either that or he just really doesn't like tomatoes. Ogborn was arrested for allegedly punching a Sonic restaurant manager after his food order came with tomatoes. The manager said Ogborn entered the employee area and started yelling at the workers. Upset that his order was wrong, he demanded a refund. The manager gave him a refund and thought Ogborn had settled down. Instead, he clocked the manager in the face and spit on his shoes. Ogborn had apparently ordered a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich and asked that they hold the tomatoes. Actually, wouldn't that just be a bacon and lettuce sandwich? Anyway, police were called and promptly arrested him on the spot. You know, while the customer is always right, he can still be a moron. Okay, in Elmhurst, Illinois man was arrested at O'Hare International Airport after he ripped off an exit sign from an aircraft that he had just exited. David Lipka, age 29, was charged with theft and criminal damage of property, both misdemeanors. Lipka had been seen pulling the sign which says Exit and Salida from the front pocket of his hoodie at about 8 p.m. Saturday at O'Hare after he had just exited a jetway from a Spirit Airlines jet. Police detained Lipka and spoke with the aircraft's captain, who said Lipka wasn't given permission to take the sign, which is used to guide occupants off the plane during an emergency. The incident caused damage, and the sign had to be reattached before the plane could depart on its next flight, per Federal Aviation Administration rules. Police said they don't know why Lipka took the sign. I guess it's just a sign of the times. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Daryl Rockwell says a bird has been harassing his cats. So when he saw it poke up above a bush outside his Grand Junction, Colorado house, he grabbed his .22 rifle, took careful aim, it was 90 feet away, and fired. The bird didn't fly off, but he did hear a woman moaning. The bird was a hawk. A woman's mohawk, more specifically, and he had just shot her in the head. Luckily, the bullet just grazed her, but she may not have even felt it. Police say she is a transient and was nearly passed out from drugs. Rockwell's attorney, Stephen Schweising, said that if his client hadn't told police what happened, he likely wouldn't have been charged with the crime, but he just couldn't live with himself, knowing what he had done and what he knew. Rockwell, who was 49, pleaded guilty to possession of a weapon by a prior offender and was sentenced to 5 years probation plus $10,000 in restitution. So there really was something foul here. The attorney. His attorney said he could have simply gotten away with it if he didn't report it. Nice. Nice. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Michael Boccia has spent decades working as a prison psychologist. He has stories to share. That's why he's written the book, On the Count, Madness, Humor, and Mental Health Care in a Maximum Security Prison. It's a fictionalized account of his early career as a prison psychologist. Michael joins us on the line from Florida. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Hi. I would assume from your experiences that what you see and what you've been through as a prison psychologist differs vastly from all the things we see in movies and television shows.
In many ways, that is probably true. One of the things that the book talks about that you don't hear too much about are some of the positive aspects of the potential for rehabilitation and the programs and dedicated corrections personnel who work in those programs. And, of course, success in those programs and for the inmates to effectively change their lives and lifestyles requires their earnest motivation to do so.
Well, let me ask you this. As someone who is a professional who went into the prison systems to work with these prisoners, did your opinion or your personal opinion about the chances and opportunities for rehabilitation change over the course of time that you worked there?
Only in regard to the difficulty with which that change could take place. Perhaps first going in, I was skeptical that inmates could change their predatory or sociopathic or Darwinistic lifestyle. But I realized after working there and meeting some of the inmate population that change was possible. But it's very difficult. In the book, we talk about behavior theory. When an individual has been habituated in criminal activity, and the important part is they have been rewarded for it, those behaviors, it's very difficult to change. So that's part of the treatment process, is to first start with the change in thinking to become more law-abiding, conscience-driven, have remorse for wrongdoing and those kinds of things, and hopefully that will follow with attitudes and behaviors that are more pro-social.
Well, what's the bigger threat here? And the reason why I ask that is that sometimes you often hear that somebody who goes into prison probably comes out as a better career criminal because of what they learned while they were in prison amongst other criminals. So is that the biggest hurdle, the negative aspect of being incarcerated with other people who are in a similar situation?
That is a problem, and it can be an impediment to effective rehabilitation, but again, it depends upon the motivation of the inmate. I mean, inmates can hang around in the wrong social circles in the penitentiary, just as they did in the free community, and learn how to do crime more effectively and decrease the chances of getting caught and prosecuted. But as I was saying, the penitentiary, most maximum security prisons and even lesser security prisons offer an awful lot of programs and dedicated people to help individuals get on a better path and start working on the attitude and the thinking, the world view, as it were, while they're doing time. And because the acid test is when they get out in the street and they're not being watched by correction officers, and they're not locked in a cell and told when to go eat and when to go recreate and all of that. So we keep our fingers crossed and we think we're reaching some people. However, the truth is, as the book points out, the recidivism rate is very high.
Okay, but you talk about the thought process of what goes on in a criminal's mind while he's in prison. In the book, you talk about some things like, for instance, a male inmate with breasts bigger than Marilyn Monroe's obtained through a hormone dispensing street doctor for the purpose of attracting other male inmates?
I'm sorry, the last thing you said was, is he a threat to other male inmates?
No, for the purpose of attracting other male inmates.
Oh, and not just male inmates. He did that behavior, that particular man that I met, very interesting guy. He did all of that hormonal change to attract males, period, in the free community. Then he committed crimes. Now he's doing time in the penitentiary. And guess what? The penitentiary is full of adult males. So he just continues his socialization as a blatant homosexual and with very attractive bodily features to men who have this pent-up testosterone, you know, and are looking to have sexual release. So he didn't do all that planning in the free community, and he didn't plan to come to prison, believe me. But because he's there, he continues to take advantage of the situation where men are desiring to have sex with someone they find appealing, and he certainly had that appeal. He would swish around on the cell block in a very fancy red robe, and my gosh, the havoc he created. A lot of fights and stabbings, and they finally had to ship him out to another penitentiary.
Well, you mentioned the idea of pent-up frustrations and active hormones and testosterone and the like. One of the things you often hear about, sadly, is things like prison riots. Have you had to deal with a situation like that? And how do you quell that as a psychologist after the fact or before the fact?
Well, in my time in the penitentiary, working there for many years, it was after the famous Attica riots. And the Attica riots occurred because of less than adequate security features of zoning off areas in the prison. We learned a lot from Attica and in 71. And later on, the zoning of different areas of the prison and better security features were adapted. But inmates will find ways to, as if they're also sexual predators, will find willing partners. Sometimes they find partners who are unwilling, and rape occurs. But the riots that occur, I'm quite sure my experience tells me, are not related to a lack of opportunities for sexual release. It's related to many other things. And if an inmate keeps a good conduct and keeps a good disciplinary record, he can become eligible for conjugal visits, 30 hours in a trailer, you know, with their spouse. And they have to have legitimate documentation that it is their wife. And if it's somebody that they want to be married to, even as an inmate, they can get married. And if they're living in the honor block and they're entitled to do conjugal visits periodically, now their new wife, or in the case of having had a wife for a long time, they can have those 30 hours visit in privacy with their wives.
When you first started to put together this book, On the Count, who did you see your core or primary audience as being? Who are you trying to reach with this book?
It started years ago when I would tell stories about the penitentiary. I never thought of myself as a writer, per se, but people would say when I would tell these frightening stories, scary stories, humorous stories about life in the penitentiary, people would say, man, Mike, you should write a book about this. And I resisted that for a long time, and then when I contacted Author House, the publisher, and I told them about my reluctance, they said, did you ever think about a co-author? And I said, I did not. And so I got a co-author, and we worked well together, and we got the book started. But the book, my original intent was to tell humorous stories and dangerous stories and realistic stories about the penitentiary, but it kind of evolved into a lot of how-to information. So many folks who have read the book or the manuscript who were in corrections and in law enforcement said that it would be a great book for criminal justice programs and people going into corrections and how to manage inmates in a correctional facility, how to do mental health treatment. And by the way, I wanted to tell you, the book is not fiction. The stories in the book are real. Only the characters are fictionalized, okay, to avoid embarrassment. Hmm. Because we had some psychiatrists, for example. One guy would come in the middle of the night, very, very bright man, intellectually and in the matters of psychiatry and medicine. He was an MD. He would come in the middle of the night saying to correction staff that he was working on reports. And he would go to his office and lock himself in. And he wasn't around inmates when he did this, but when they did a random search of his office, they found a beautiful pair of leopard skin bra and panties and a whole jar of amphetamines and a whole jar of reefer. So this guy was kind of getting his jollies in the middle of the night in the penitentiary. Serious, serious violation of ethics and rules, and just a form of madness. He actually lapsed into a psychotic state and had to be treated because he came apart at the scene.
Wow, the book is called On the Count. Certainly is an interesting recollection of a lot of stories taking place while working in a maximum security prison. I thank you very, very much, Michael, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Michael Boccia, author of On the Count, Madness, Humor, and Mental Health Care in a Maximum Security Prison. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0140, and you'll find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. About a month ago, I told you about one of the most confusing judicial opinions I'd ever heard. A judge said that the National Labor Relations Board, known as the NLRB, could order job providers to put up posters with all kinds of rules, but that the board didn't have the power to enforce that rule. It just didn't make sense. Now, a couple of weeks later, a different federal judge has issued a much more sensible ruling on the same issue. He said that the NLRB does not have the authority to order job providers to post the rules in the first place, so no enforcement necessary. Now that makes sense. Let's be fair. These two opinions reveal a lot about how our justice system works. Different judges can look at the same issue and come to very different conclusions. So who's right? Well, guess what? The confusing first opinion was just overturned by a federal appeals court, and the final decision may now be up to the Supreme Court. So stay tuned. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is The Stuff File.
It's time once again for yet another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. Over the last 25 years or so, I've had the pleasure to talk with some great stars of the past. This time around, it's a chat that I had back in November of 2004. It was with Academy Award-winning actor Carl Malden. At the time we chatted, he was just about to receive another award. It was the Monte Cristo Award from the Eugene O'Neill Theatre Company. And he was 92 years old at the time and a great storyteller. Here's part of that interview now.
Now, in addition to all the work you've done on stage and television, films, were you not also at one point president of the Guild?
I was president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences for 3 years. That's right.
What exactly are the duties involved when you are the president of that auspicious body?
Well, I don't know what the duties are for the other presidents, but I'll tell you what mine was.
Okay.
I became president in the first year. Someone had a bright idea. We have a beautiful theater, film, movie theater. Said, the seats are terrible. They've been in there for 20 years. We've got to change them. So the board voted on changing the seats. Well, we changed the seats, and someone said, listen, while they're out, let's change the carpet. And the fellow says, fine, we'll change the carpet. At the same time, we ought to have the curtain before the screen match the carpet. Good. Well, while everything is out and gutted, why don't we paint the house? So it started that way, and before it was done, the whole place cost about $7 million to fix. Then another thing we had, we have a library. I think it's a great film library in the country. And there was a fund for that, but nobody was doing anything about it. And I called the man who was in charge, and I said, what's happening? And he said, well, no one has asked me to do anything. Well, I'm asking you to do something. So he said, you've got to come with me. And for 3 years, we raised $12 million, and I had to go with him. And that's something that embarrassed me, but I did it. And we have now a beautiful library in California, in Los Angeles, and it's one of the top film libraries in the country. And I'm proud of that. So that was another $6 million. So whenever I met the board, and I'd say, I'll be the president, bankrupt the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So that was my reputation.
Now, if somebody out there decides to go out and rent all your films or some of your television shows, some of the work you've done, there's a little game that they can all play. I know I enjoy playing this game. I wait for the film, and you've done such films as we mentioned. There's On the Waterfront, Gypsy, How the West Was Won, Patton, and so many other great films. Streetcar Named Desire, which you won the Academy Award for. We like to sit down and watch and wait till you mention the name Sokolovich. Tell us about that.
Well, that's my real name.
Right.
And naturally it was changed. And I felt when I had to change the name, I felt a little touched about it. And I thought maybe my father would say, well, what sort of thing is this? So I made it a point. The first time you'll hear it is an On the Waterfront. And it was put in there by the director, Kazan. And then I thought, well, this is good. I'll put it in every picture I'm in or any film I'm in. And I did. And I saw it and made sure there was a lot of... It's in Patton.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Birdman of Alcatraz. I couldn't find anywhere to say it. So I told the director or the prop man, I said, put a sign over one of the cells and put Sokolovich up there. So that when I brought in the new a man in charge, I started out Jim, Jack, Jackson, Sokolovich, went right down the line. And when my dad saw the film, he called me up immediately. He said, my son, I want you to know, he had a Turkish accent, I want you to know, a Sokolovich was never in prison. So that was the Sokolovich story.
Now, when did people start, when did others start noticing what you were doing? When did film buffs start noticing that you were doing this?
I think they didn't know it until about, maybe 3 or 4 years before I left the business. Because I never told anyone.
Well, we did catch on. Someone like yourself who again, we mentioned the Academy Award, you know, a lot of times you hear stories about actors who kind of poo-poo the idea of doing a television series because they've had a career on the big screen and on Broadway. Was it a difficult prospect for you to want to come to television, or were you quite prepared to do it?
Well, I never did television before I did Streets. And I must admit, I'm embarrassed to say, that I poo-pooed it also. I stayed away from it. But when the time came, I told the agent, I said, I'll do it, but I'm going to do it the right way. I'm either going to star or not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally got me this series, which I starred in with Michael. And it's one of the best things I ever did because I made a lot of money off of that show. It ran 5 years. And I followed that with a thing that ran 21 years. That's American Express Traveler's Checks.
Yes.
And I tell people even today, don't leave home without
them. Was that 21 years you did that?
I did that for 21 years. And between those two, I can say I'm sitting here talking to you right now.
Now, when you did The Streets of San Francisco, I heard a story, and maybe you can share that with us. You're doing the scenes with Michael Douglas, and Michael is a young whippersnapper behind the wheel of the car, and he just takes off down the road.
Oh, that was the first year.
The first year.
That was scary. We don't laugh at that much, but it happened. We went down a street, California Street, in San Francisco, Knob Hill. Now, you know San Francisco, first, is a lot of hills, up and down.
Right.
Steep hills. And Michael drives a car very well. He's a good driver. And he went down California, made a left turn in front of the hotel, and a half a block, and then there's a hill. And he didn't realize how steep, and he was going about 65 miles an hour, and before you know it, we were airborne. There was no street under us, no street. So finally, I looked at Michael, and I said, what the hell is this? I said, and he panicked, but thank God we landed safe and tore out the whole bottom of the car, but everything ended out all right.
Hmm.
But that's the first, one of the first episodes we did. From then on, we did, still go fast, but believe me, we made sure of where we were going.
Now, again, like I said, he's a young kid, one of his first gigs as an actor. You're one of the contemporaries of his dad.
Yes, I was.
Who was he more afraid of, the producer, the director, or you after that?
No, I don't. I that's a tough one to answer. I don't think he was afraid of anybody.
Okay.
I don't. With me, there was no mention of fear at all. We just had such a wonderful time. And doing it because it was hard work, and if we hadn't had a wonderful time, it would have been terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But we worked well together, and I'll tell you how he got the job, but at least how it happened. The producer saw him. He called me to the office and said, I want you to meet a young man who I think will be good for you. I came to the office. I stepped inside, and I looked at him, and I said, he'll do. And the producer said, well, you haven't even talked to him. I said, I don't have to. I looked at Michael, and I said, no, I never met Michael before.
Mm-hmm.
I said, are you a Douglas? He said, yes. So the producer said, how did you know? I said, look at his chin. Look at that chick. Look at that. That's Michael. That's Kirk. And he was Kirk Douglas' son, and I said, that's good enough for me. Kirk and I started in summer stock together for a couple of years, and we've been very close and very... You know, he's a big star, and he went his way, and I went mine, but we see each other quite often.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned that with all the work you've done, all the traveling, all the sets, that you didn't get a chance to spend a lot of time with your daughters when they were growing up. You ended up writing or co-authoring your biography with your daughter.
I did.
Was that an opportunity while you were writing that book with your daughter to get to know each other?
Well, I did that when I... The first thing I did was write the book, Memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it for about a month. She came over one day and said, how's it going? And I said, well, it's going pretty good. I'm happy. She went to go home and said, can I read what you've written? I gave it to her. She came back the next morning and said, can I come back here and do it with you? I said, how's that? I'll bring my laptop computer, and you tell me the stories. I said, sure. I said, but why? She said, I think you tell a better story than you write. So she sat in and did it, and I think it worked out that way much better. And I'm so pleased. It is true, if I may say so on your station, if you ever have an opportunity to work with one of your sons or daughters in a thing like that, do it. It's a great experience. We laughed and we cried an awful lot. And I'm telling you, we know each other like we've never known each other before.
Mm. Now, in addition to doing stage, as you said you did earlier in your career, you also did a lot of radio, did you not?
I did. I shouldn't say I did, but I did do radio to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest shows I was on is a show called Our Gal Sunday. And I did that for a year. I was a heavy in that one. And right next door was a very dear, dear friend of mine, which we weren't then, but we got to know each other, was Front Page Farrell, starring Richard Widmark.
Oh, yes.
And between the shows, after the show, we'd go out and have a drink with the rest of the people. We'd go to a bar, and we'd sit at the bar, and I'd order a ginger ale, and he would order a glass of milk. And that was our association for years, and we still talk to each other an awful lot of time. He's in New York now, and I live here.
Was it a different time when it came to the actors working together, the camaraderie, than it is today?
I don't know what you mean by different time.
And, you know, you hear stories, and I've had a chance to talk to actors from different eras, and there just seems to be a more of a camaraderie in what people were doing, be it in Broadway or early television, early radio, than you seem to hear about today.
Well, the difficulty in our profession is when you get into a film will last maybe 10 weeks or 12 weeks to make. And in that time, you're working every day, long hours, and you become a family. Even the crew, everybody becomes one unit for that time. And when it's over, it's like a divorce. You don't see each other for a long time again. So you start all over. So you get to make a lot of friends, but really there's no friendship involved. But in the theater, if a play is a hit, you know, it runs 2 years, 3 years, you really become close to the people you're working with. So I think there was that. But it's a different business altogether today than what it was 30 years ago.
You mentioned that you started on Streets of San Francisco with a then-unknown actor by the name of Michael Douglas. You've had an opportunity to work with some very talented unknowns early in their career. You started years ago, you did Streetcar Named Desire with a newcomer by the name of Marlon Brando.
Yes.
When you work with people like this, kids who are coming along...
They're not kids. They're grown up.
Yeah. Do you see the spark, though, that... can you look at somebody and say, oh, that person's going to be a star?
Well, I tell you what, I saw that in Marlon.
Mm-hmm.
He's a genius. We did two plays together, and we did three films together. And in the two plays, the first one, we both played small parts. And the scene he had was about 6 minutes long. And when the play stopped, when he left, the play stopped. I mean, the audience wouldn't let him leave. They clapped, shouted, stamped their feet. And I thought, well, this is sensational. And then I worked with him in Streetcar Named Desire. And I wanted to see whether it could happen again. I realized that he had something that no other actor I've ever worked with had. And I wish I knew what it was completely, because I would have stolen it and used it. but it's something that he does. Other people try to do it. They cannot do it. Only he can do it, and that is on film. He can look at you and stop and look at you for a minute and a half, and it's still alive. The boys are doing it today. They look and they look, but it's dead screen. It's a dead screen. Nothing's happening.
Mm-hmm.
He has something that I wish I could tell you his eyes, what it is. I've looked, I've worked, I've tried. It's an inner quality that he has that I wish I could explain it.
Well, I think you've explained it very well, and I also think you are selling yourself short by not saying that you don't have it yourself. Up to the very end, when I saw the episode where you did The West Wing,
yes.
There is a way that you do a scene that is believable and natural, and to me, it's not acting, it's Carl Malden. I wish you well with the award you're going to get tomorrow, the Monte Cristo Award, well-deserved, and I thank you for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Pleasure talking to you, and keep warm.
We will.
Okay.
And enjoy the award. Enjoy Michael and enjoy your life. Thank you for being on the program with us, sir.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That was part of an interview with Academy Award winner Carl Malden. I spoke with Carl in November of 2004. Carl Malden passed away on July 1st, 2009 from natural causes. He was 97. You can hear the full half-hour interview with Carl on my website at thestufffile.com. Click on the Celebrity Audio Files and you'll find the interview with Carl and also interviews with others. They're all listed in alphabetical order and you can play them right off the page.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about wrapping up this edition of the Stuff File program. And of course, we have an idiot of the day, but a few more stories before we get there. And a couple of those stories we've put together, and we like to call them Great Art, But Why? Two British designers who claim they had the idea independently and learned of each other only after they finished, recently produced elegant pieces using parts of a 2012 Ford Focus. Judy Clark made a dress and a biker jacket adorned with car keys, radio, and dashboard components, seat covers, a speedometer, and red taillights. Catherine Hawkins created a necklace using dial springs, buttons, seat materials, and instrument panel switches. I don't know why either. And also, Swiss artist Christophe Bouchel has now secured local permits to bury a Boeing 727 38 feet under a patch of California's Mojave Desert near Bakersfield. Visitors will take a tunnel down in order to tour the 153-foot-long airplane. Okay, interesting concepts all, but aren't you just a little bit concerned about the initial thought process that goes through somebody's mind when coming up with ideas like this? Yeah, me too. Police in Massachusetts said an accused purse snatcher was arrested after he bummed a cigarette from his alleged victim 2 days later. Leominster police said a woman whose purse was taken at knife point at the Heritage Gardens apartment complex recognized Malik Matos, age 25, of Fitchburg, when he asked her for a cigarette 2 days later outside the Registry of Motor Vehicles. The woman told RMV employees, and they called police. Matos was arrested and charged with armed robbery. He was ordered held in lieu of a $5,000 bail. Now, if you're going to be a mugger, at least work on your short-term memory. That's all I have to say. And believe it or not, a Cheez-It cracker attack sent a Palm Bay, Florida woman to the hospital. Police say Andy Gatz became angry with his wife for the ridiculous reason that she went to an Earth Day concert. In his rage, he threw a box of Cheez-Its at her. Yeah. Yvonne Martinez, a spokeswoman for the Palm Bay Police Department, said a small square cracker apparently went right into her right eye and caused her injury. The woman was treated at a local hospital's emergency room. Oh, the dangers of snack foods. And thought of almost everything, that'll be the section in this story. Michelle Salzgeber, age 20, was arrested in March in Newport Richey, Florida, after failing a drug test. Now, there was a condition of her probation to pass a drug test for an undisclosed crime. Now, apparently, Michelle knew that she would probably fail her own drug test, so she had gone to the trouble of inserting a small tube of someone else's urine inside her vagina. Unfortunately for her, a pre-test body scan revealed a tube. And here's the best part. Besides the fact that she had this tube inside her, authorities tested the urine in the tube and found that it also failed. Yeah, good going. Smart. She could have been the idiot of the day, but she wasn't. But this next story, well, that's the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
We've all seen stupid things and known stupid people. Heck, we've even done some stupid things in our own. But taking the concept to a pure art form is one 20-year-old Michael Baker of Jenkins, Kentucky, who decided to post on Facebook a picture of himself siphoning gas from a police car. The photo shows Michael squatting down near the rear of the police car with a siphoning hose in the gas tank while he smiles at the camera and proudly shows off his middle finger. A lot of people saw the photo, including a few officers of the Jenkins Police Department, who promptly arrested Mr. Baker and charged him with theft by unlawful taking. Not amused by the photo at all, Police Chief Alan Borms said that if Baker would steal from police, he'd steal from just about anybody. Authorities say they now plan to buy lockable gas caps for their patrol cars. Now, why would someone be not only bold enough to steal gas from a police car, but take a picture of said crime and then post it on Facebook? Well, one reason and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0140. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0140. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.